Thank you for joining us today for another podcast from Flushing Community Church. We are real people seeking to understand the truth revealed in God's Word. You can join us every Sunday at our place of gathering in Flushing, Michigan. Find out more by visiting flushingcommunity.org.
Have you ever felt like someone just gets all the breaks? I mean, there are just people, maybe a person in your life that no matter what happens, it seems like everything falls into place for them. Everything falls into a nice little package. And you love them for it, don't you? You know, they've got all the right family connections that lead to the perfect job and the perfect salary and the perfect hours and the perfect family. And you love them for it all. Maybe you felt like everyone else around you has everything all put together. Everything is in a nice order. And then when you look at your house and you look at what you endure and when you look at what obstacles are in front of you, you get very easily frustrated. You know, it's easy for us to live in a world of comparison. Really easy. But we have to have our eyes open because there are others. These are the folks we don't like to talk about because their hard times are so difficult and so deep that their pain is kind of unimaginable for us. It would almost appear for some that somehow they made God so mad at some point in their life that He's just stepping on them like a bug. And you know, you just look at their life and you just break because of all the adversity and the pain and the trials that they've gone through. We have very good friends back from college days who have faced trial after trial after trial. And I was thinking of them this week while I was putting some of this together. Divorce of their parents, a car accident that left a brother in really bad shape, suicide of a father, repeated drug and alcohol-related issues in family members, sick children, sole responsibility of aging parents, and the list goes on and on. And I just think, man, why is it that it seems like everything fell their way so poorly, and yet when I look at others, things seem to fall together so nicely. So I just kind of have this question as we get started today. Why is it that some have it so easy and some have it so difficult? That question kind of permeated my mind when I was thinking about our character that we're going to spend the next 4 weeks of the Bible, 4 weeks of our time together. And I thought of that being a part of his life. David was a person who was born the youngest son of a shepherding family in a lowly, lowly town in Bethlehem. The only future for David was really going to be doing chores that nobody else would do. As the youngest member of the family, David couldn't have many big dreams. He couldn't take over the family business. He couldn't compete with his brothers for captain of the shearing team. I mean, it was not the brightest of outlooks. It was great to be the oldest son. It was always great to be the oldest son. But David wasn't that. He was the youngest in his family. But his story is one of these stories of rags to riches. One of these stories that I love to see people rise out of their circumstances and enable to be something greater than they ought to be, according to our culture. Because something was about to happen in David's life. Something was about to take place that would change his life and the life and the lives, really, of the nation of Israel forever. David was destined to be like thousands of shepherds who lived before him in complete obscurity. Those kind of people that you just kind of look past. But God was about to use him to do something that would make his name be a household name. Songs would be written on his behalf. He was about to be something totally different. Months ago, I was thinking about our services and kind of planning what we should be talking about and really praying and seeking God. What do you want us to be talking about as a church? Where can we go in our conversation? And as we develop this dangerous church model that we just finished up last week, I was thinking, what can we follow up with this idea of living dangerously for Christ? What can we follow up by that idea of living with the Holy Spirit and with love and with boldness? And this person came to my mind. David. A person who understood the Holy Spirit's role in his life even before the Holy Spirit was released like it is today. A person who understood love better than maybe any man in his era ever did. A person who understood boldness and faith. A person who lived by all those characters and all those traits. So I decided that we would spend some time reacquainting ourselves with this Old Testament icon. This person who changed the course of his nation. Not by his own strength, but by his willingness to be faithful and obedient to the Lord. So I ask a couple of questions. And you have an insert today that if you would like to follow along, it will kind of guide you in our conversation a little bit. By the way, I'll remind you that on the inside of that insert will be some readings of David and some of the Psalms that he wrote and various things like that as well. I encourage you to take that out if you'd like to and follow along with us today. But why is it so important for us to look at David's life today? Two important reasons that I think give us the reason to give David attention today. Number one, he's a key figure in the life of the genealogy of Jesus. This isn't just a person in the Old Testament that rose up and God blessed. This is a person who had a divine calling. He was set apart for a divine purpose. There are 14 generations from Abraham, who we'll talk about in a moment, to David. 14 more generations between David and when the people of Israel were scattered and sent in exile. And 14 more generations from the time they reunified to the time of Christ. You see, there is nothing done by accident when it comes to the Lord. Nothing too late and nothing too early. The second reason that I think it's important for us to look at David is that he really embodies, for me, what it means to pursue godliness. In Acts 13, which we read this past Wednesday in our small group as a part of Wednesday Night Boost, Paul says this when testifying about God's people. And I'm going to walk over here and grab this water that I sat down earlier, because the food that's in the back of my throat that disappeared for a while is back. When it comes to talking about the godliness of David's heart, this is what was testified about him in Acts 13. God testified concerning him, "I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do." Now, I would love for the Lord to testify about me like that. Would you like that? If God were to look down on you and say, "Listen, you are a person after my own heart because you will do what I need you to do." David was a man who understood and lived a holy life. Not a perfect life, a holy life. And he honored God throughout his life. And that's demonstrated by his holiness and his godliness. I'm really excited for this summer. A little teaser for what we're going to do after this series. Throughout the summer months, we're going to be looking at the story of God. Literally, from the book of Genesis all the way through the book of Revelation in 9 different sermons that will be spoken by 4 different voices. It's going to be really neat for us to kind of develop the story of God. But for the sake of just kind of getting a handle of where David fits into this, I feel like it would be good for us to just kind of give a really quick overview of where this is. Again, there's room in your bulletin or room in your insert if you'd like to kind of just take some notes and kind of keep this in the back of your mind. The story of God really starts with a man named Abram. Abram was a man who, like David, kind of was in the shepherding, livestocking business. His dad moved him to a place. He was actually on his way to a special land, and he got about halfway there, and he parked his tent, and he never moved again. So Abram was born and raised believing that God was sending people to great places to do great things, but his father fell short. One day, God came to Abram and said, "I want you to pack up everything you have, and I want you to go to a land that I'll show you." So Abram's immediately remembering where they were going to go with his father, and he takes all of his stuff, and he begins to head that direction, and sure enough, God begins to use him. In the process of this faithful obedience, God establishes a covenant with Abram, changes his name to Abraham, and begins to promise him that he'll be the father of a great nation. He has sons, even in old age. Isaac, who has then Jacob. Jacob, who wrestles with God and whose name is changed to Israel, who then has 12 sons, the 11th of which is named Joseph. I just skirted over a lot of chapters of the Bible. We get to Joseph, and we see an amazing story where his brothers become jealous and he's sold off into slavery and he ends up in a land called Egypt, away from his family. Again, all these promises that Joseph saw, all the dreams that Joseph had, and now he lands in the people of Egypt. God blesses him and he rises to authority in this land, even as a foreigner. Meanwhile, where Israel is, Jacob and his sons, a drought hits their land and they need the people of Egypt to help them get through this drought. And God reunites this family together, and Joseph, through all of his wealth and power in Egypt, says, "Come live with me," and so they do. Over time, we forget about Joseph, we forget about Isaac, we forget about his family, and the people of Egypt become contempt against these Israelites, and they put them into slavery. Then all of a sudden, for 400 years, the people of God are making bricks and building all these things in the land of Egypt. And God doesn't seem to be in the picture at all, until God raises up another. His name is Moses. And he goes and he says, "I want you to go get my people, and I want you to take them out of Egypt." And he does. And it's a fantastic story of God's faithfulness and people following the Lord. This one-time family who went and lived in Egypt now as a nation, they were bonded by their own discomfort and slavery, and they come out of there a nation, 1.5 million strong. And as God leads them and is about to take them into the promised land, they get confused and they make terrible decisions and they walk away from the Lord and they build idols out of all their gold and they just do crazy things. And God says, "You know what? Because of that, I'm going to make you wander around in this wilderness for 40 years as a punishment." And so they do. And all the people that really came out of Egypt, they never got to see that promised land. God gave it to them eventually through a man named Joshua. And so as Joshua leads people into the promised land, and all these people around them see Israelites have a God who really follows up with some strength and power, there became some agitation amongst the people. And people were battling against Israel. So 12 different judges were chosen throughout their history to rule over them. It would kind of go like this. There would be a nation battle against Israel, and someone would rise up and defeat this enemy. And then they would be kind of done the judge. They would be the new leader of God's people. And there would be a period of peace. And then that judge would go away or die, and then there would be a new enemy, and then a new judge, and a new season of peace. And then the people of God would do something evil, and people would come against them, and God's hand of blessing would be removed from them, and then a new judge, and then a season of peace. And this repeated over and over and over and over again, until one day the people of Israel said, "Listen, I think we would like to have our own king. Maybe our problem is that we don't have a leader here. Maybe our problem is God. Maybe our problem is we need to have someone in charge." Well, during this time, during this debate, that there was a famine in the area of Bethlehem. Elimelech and his family decided to leave this land, and he took his two sons and his wife and everything he had, and he went to the land of Moab, which was in the northeastern region of Egypt. And he went there, and he began to settle down. His sons met Moabite women and fell in love and got married, and everything was going well. They flourished. And one day, Elimelech died. 10 years later, his sons suffered the same thing, and they passed away. So here now is a widow with two daughter-in-laws living in a foreign land of which they have also been raised in because they're Moabite women. Naomi is the name of the widow. And she goes to her daughter-in-laws and she says, "I'm going back to my homeland." And she says, "I free you to go back to your family. I release you of the bonds to my family and I let you go back, and may God be with you." One of those women took her up on that offer and returned to her family, never to be heard from again. But one of them said, "Where you go, I will go. Where your people are, that's where I will be. I am with you." And so Ruth joins Naomi and heads back to Bethlehem. As the course of time, they meet up with their family, and there's a rich tradition in this culture called a kinsman redeemer. That when a husband of a lady dies, that it would be the next brother's responsibility or the next kinship relationship to that person who would bring on this woman as a wife and to take her on as a part of their family. And the story goes that Boaz meets up with Ruth, and he claims her basically as the kinsman redeemer. It's a really gorgeous story. And they are married. Now let's jump back into what's going on in the nation at this time. At this point in time is when Samuel hears the grumbling of God's people saying that they want this king. And he's going to God and saying, this is a terrible idea. And God is saying, you're right, it is a terrible idea. And so Samuel actually goes to the people and he tells them this from 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel gives them a clear warning. This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He tells them, he will take your sons and make them serve with chariots and horses, and they will run in front of chariots. In other words, he's going to put your kids in harm's way. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cookers and bakers, cooks and bakers, cookers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. And when that day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. But the Lord will not answer you on that day. The Lord was trying to convince these people that this form of government was not what would be the best for them. Anybody feel like they were articulating government in general as we were reading through that? It's pretty accurate. 3,000 years ago. Well, the Lord eventually relents and says, listen, Samuel, give them what they want. And they chose Saul to be the first king of Israel. Back in Bethlehem, Ruth and Boaz joined in marriage, have a son, Obed. Obed grows, gets married, and has a son. His name is Jesse. And it was probably about that time that Saul was anointed king over Israel, when Jesse was coming into his manhood and married and starting to have children. And he has all of his sons, one of them being David. Isn't it amazing that you look in the story and the heritage of David, that this Ruth story connects with it so clearly? 1 Samuel 15 tells a story that Saul, in his first years of reigning, actually did some great things. He was a good king who defended the nation, and God came to him and said, I need you to go, and I need you to destroy the people known as the Amalekites. Now, these are people who did not allow God's people to travel through their land quite a long time ago, when they were leaving Egypt. Remember, there are a lot of generations between Abram and David. So the time between this time where they had left for Egypt and now living in this era was quite a bit of time. But God said, I want to destroy these people because they treated us harshly when we were leaving Egypt. And the word was this, and this is difficult. These are the pictures of God that are difficult to preach. But he said, I want you to go to this land and I want you to annihilate it. I don't want there to be anything living. I don't want there to be a man, a woman, or a child. I don't want there to be even any form of livestock. I want you to annihilate it and leave it desolate. That was the command. Now David went with his army 200,000 strong. He marches in and he destroys almost everything. He thought it would be a good idea to bring the king, Agag, with him and his family. So he did that. And they chose the best of the livestock to save as well. It was in this moment that Samuel comes along and says, "What are you doing? That was not what you were told to do." And David rationalizes his actions by saying, "Listen, everybody's dead but the king. We thought he might have..." Did I say it wrong?
Saul.
He went to Saul and said, "What are you doing?" Not David. Not yet. Thank you. I like that teleprompter. It's very helpful for me. Anyways, I'm getting confused, and now you are too. Samuel goes to Saul and says, "What are you doing?" I'm really glad you're listening, by the way, Steve. I think I might be battling a moment of ADHD right now. What was I thinking? Okay, I'm just kidding. Everybody's with me. "What are you doing?" And he rationalizes his actions by saying, "We kept the king alive. And what we decided to do is keep all of the best of this livestock to offer as a burnt offering to the Lord." Now that might seem like a reasonable thing to do, but that's not what God asked him to do. God didn't want a burnt offering of their livestock. He did not like those people. He wanted everything annihilated. And it was in that moment that God kind of turned his back on Saul. And he realized that this was a man who was going to do what he wanted to do instead of a man who would do what I need him to do. And his hand of blessing, though he was still king, God's hand of blessing came off of Saul. This was a sad and dark time for the people of Israel. This was a time of confusion and frustration, I'm sure. But eventually, the Lord comes back to Samuel the prophet. And he says, "I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king." This is recorded in 1 Samuel 16. So Samuel arrives at Jesse's home, declares that he will offer a sacrifice for the family. Not really telling them what he will do, but saying, "I want to offer a sacrifice and blessing to your family." And so we pick up in verse 6. Because Samuel asks Jesse to bring all of his sons into the house. He wants to have this to be a family celebration. "So when they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, 'Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord.'" He was the oldest son. "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at things that people look at. People look at outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" This is a key passage of understanding the character of God, friends. After one, after another, Samuel looks at the sons of Jesse, and God rejects each of them. Finally, he says, is this all you have? Is this all you've got? And Jesse says, "No, there's still one more, but he's my youngest. He's the one that has to do everything that nobody else wants to do. He's the one that has to stay in the fields. When we have a party, he has to keep working. He's the one that really doesn't have a great future. He's my youngest son. I love him, but he's my youngest son." And Samuel says, "Go get him and bring him here." So picking up in verse 12, "So he sent for him and had him brought in. Now David was glowing with health and had fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, 'Rise and anoint him. This is the one.' So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David." Now, let me just make this point again. David should not have been chosen here. It didn't add up according to everything that their culture knew and understood. Strike one was that he was from the town of Bethlehem. For centuries, people would say, "What good will come out of Bethlehem?" Nothing. He was from the wrong side of the tracks. Strike two was that he was the youngest son. They're never chosen for anything good. Strike three was that he was a shepherd. Shepherds were not people that got much credit at all in their society. They were kind of the garbage men of their world. They had a job to do to provide, but it was always out and away. Their families always struggled because they would spend days and weeks and months away from home. It was not the kind of job many people wanted. So here's David. It just doesn't make sense. But here's David, and God anoints him to be the next king over his people. Not too early, not too late, but always right on time. Remember, the Lord does not look at things that people look at. And we're good at looking at things and making judgments, aren't we? People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. I thought about that phrase, the Lord looks at the heart. And I began to wonder, what would God see when He sees my heart? How does God view me? How does He see my heart? And I began to ask myself, what do we see in David's heart? So let's look at that. Three things that I think David's heart exemplifies for us today. Number one, he's obedient. Saul had decided that he would do whatever seemed right to him, but David would be a person who would do right in the eyes of God. This was an important characteristic of David's heart. This is something that I believe God planted in his heart because he needed him to be obedient. Too often, I think we're put in a place of judgment and we try to make choices based on what we think would be best. And we leave out the most important person in that equation, and that's the Lord. David was obedient, even when it didn't make sense. David was obedient, even though it didn't feel right all the time or make sense from that standpoint. David would always do what God needed him to do. The second thing that I find when I look into David's heart is that he's courageous. He's courageous. Saul would send others to the front lines to do the battle, but David was a warrior who, even as a child, would defend his flock from the fiercest of enemies. This is kind of disconnected, but in chapter 17, and I don't want to get to that part of the story in its entirety, but David is speaking to Saul, who's still king, and David is anointed to be the next king, but isn't king yet, and he's addressing the king. And he's basically telling him why he is being brave in this particular scene and moment. And he says, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep." These are David's words. "And when a lion or a bear would come and carry off the sheep of the flock, I would go after it and strike it and rescue the sheep from its mouth. And when it turned on me, I seized it by its hair and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear." Now, I don't know about you, and I'm not a hunter. Many of you know that. But that would scare me to death. Right? I think I'm a fairly courageous individual, but I'm not stupid. How many of you would chase down a lion or a bear that's got one of your sheep, knock it on the side of the head, take the sheep out of its mouth, start taking off again, and when that thing would come after you again, you'd turn around and grab it by the mane, grab it by the ears, and kill it. David sits here with all of this thing in his heart, this courage, that he believes God will protect him. And he goes after the lion and after the bear and anything that gets in his way. It's the heart of God. A man after his own heart, a man who is obedient, and a man who will face the greatest dangers for the sake of protecting that which he loves. The third thing that I find as I look at the heart of David is I see an honest heart. You cannot read the Psalms that he wrote. You cannot read the poems that he put into pen without seeing a heart that is completely honest. A heart that says, "Where are you, God? You have left me to be eaten by my enemies." Many of us would not be so brave to say that. David was. He was willing to be honest to his brothers who are at the camp. In just a little while, we'll look at it next week and say, "Why are you sitting here in fear? This is crazy. Let's go take care of this enemy." He was honest. Saul would always twist his behaviors to work in his favor. David would always stand upon the truth of God, no matter what. Really, outside of one horrible scene in David's life, he always stood on truth. And he recognized that that was the best way to live. Well, next week we're going to look at the next phase of David's life, when his heart is really put to the test, when we see this heart that we've kind of looked at today really put to the test, then we're going to see how David operates under great stress. But I have a final question for us today. How can we live more like David in our world? How can we be people, men and women, moms and dads, teenagers and children, who are more like David? Is it possible for us, with all of the pressure of our culture, our schedule, our media, our battles, to have a heart like this? Can we live with this level of obedience? Can we function with this level of courageousness? Can we love and long for honesty and integrity like David? Can we take the lions in our life and give them a giant smack alongside of the head? And when they attack again, would we be willing to charge right back at them and grab them by their hair and tell them, "Not on my watch"? Tell you what, our schools need Davids walking the halls. Our workplaces need Davids serving and leading with this kind of strength and integrity. Our government needs this kind of king who would live for the Lord and not for popularity. Our churches need Davids. Our churches need Davids to stand among us and remind us, especially to remind those of us who are shaking in our armor, that the Lord has already won the battle and the enemy will not defeat us, even if he's a smelly giant. We need more Davids who will take God's word to heart and run from sin, who will stand on righteousness and set the pace for the world in true godliness. My prayer for today is that our hearts of stone would be shattered and that our hearts would be turned into God's own heart, that we would have a heart that doesn't yearn for the comforts of our world, but a heart that yearns for the things of God, the things that are eternal, the things that are right, the things that are holy. David didn't long for comfort. He didn't long for security. He longed for the things of God. He understood the matchless love of God and promises, and the promises that come from living a life of righteousness and praise before the Lord. I know what my heart looks like. I don't know what your heart looks like. But I know that I want to have a heart that's clearer. I want to have a heart that looks more like David. So that someday the Lord can look at Terry and say, "That was a man after my own heart." I want to live in obedience. I want to live with courage. And I want to bank on honesty and integrity. And I want you to as well. My prayer for throughout this series is that we would be people who would inhabit the form and the heart of David. That we would become worshipers and warriors. That we would become leaders and people who would be willing to look inside of us with great honesty and transparency. I believe that David had it right in many ways when he would look to the Lord and say, "Your love endures forever." He wouldn't look at his enemies. He would look to the Lord as his strength and his shield. And I believe David worshipped better than anyone we have ever seen before. We're going to pray. We're going to sing a song in closing. And we're going to just ask God to help us to become more like Him today. We're going to ask Him to help us become more like His own heart. And that we may go from this place changed and challenged, transformed into His likeness. That we could serve the Lord like David did.
Thanks for spending these minutes with us at Flushing Community Church. If you would like to speak with someone regarding today's message, please contact our office at 810-732-0282. or visit flushingcommunity.org.